To you, Jules, and to everybody at London Councils in turning up in such enormous numbers on this very wet Saturday morning. In fact, it was one of the 6% of the time when it is raining in London, as I discovered on my bicycle on my way here. But you've come here in huge numbers, probably more people than voted in the Police Crime and Commissioner elections put together. Such is the fascination and importance of this subject, which is the future of our great city, which I think you'll agree, putting modesty aside, has had a fantastic year, hasn't it, so far? I mean, you know, electorally speaking, obviously things went more or less okay. In May, I can't imagine that we're going to agree entirely on every detail, but you will remember, before the Olympic and the Paralympics, how nervous we all were. Do you remember the gloom and the anxiety and the nail-biting that went on when the tube, you know, was the thing called the conductor shoe kept falling off the bottom of the shoe, and the buses went on strike and the taxis went on strike and the G4S employees seemed to have discovered alternative employment as short-order chefs in Mexico or whatever it was that they were doing. And then it's worth remembering this pessimism because I think we share it collectively as a city and indeed as a country about what we can do. And then, pow, sometime in the middle of that first week, round about the moment, I think when Bradley Wiggins, as he's called in France, Bradley Wiggins won his gold medal, it seemed as though nothing could go wrong, didn't it? And everybody turned up, the G4S guys were there, the transport system functioned absolutely beautifully, didn't it? Wasn't it one of the Jubilee line about which everybody had been so concerned? Did fantastically well. And the only transport system that malfunctioned was, of course, a zip wire in Victoria Park. And since we're congratulating London County, I want to pay a particular tribute to the health and safety official in Tower Hamlets who assured me moments before I strapped myself in that it was all functioning perfectly. But I want to make a serious point this morning, and that is to ask you to focus your minds on why do you think it all worked, and what is the key lesson that we in London have to draw? And I don't think it was the spirit of London, magnificent though that is. I don't think it was just the amazing achievements of LOCOG and Seb Coe. I don't think it was just the ODA. I don't think it was even London Councils, who are the unsung hero of the project, and did an amazing job of helping to get hold the streets ready, to help to create the look and feel of London. London Councils were integral in creating the party atmosphere that dazzled the world, and you guys did an absolutely fantastic job. But with all due respect to London Councils, I don't think it was just London Councils. I'm afraid, and this is may sound a paradoxical thing for a free market conservative to say, but I think the reason the Olympics and the Paralympics were such a knockout, soar-away, smash hit was because they were planned. They were planned and planned and planned. They were planned with love and care and devotion for 7 years. And they were planned with, as far as possible, this is the crucial point, as far as possible with a cross-party consensus about what was going to be needed and what we would have to do as a city to succeed. And everybody knew what the problems were going to be, didn't they? Because they were well advertised in the media, apart from anything else. And everybody knew what we were going to have to do to solve those problems. And I think... Is that me or you? That is me. I'm sorry. Do you know, I'll tell you what it is. It's my alarm clock going off on American time, ludicrously. Forgive me. Everybody knew what we were going to have to do. And I want us to take the lesson of the Olympics and apply it now, as Jules has rightly said, to what we're going to have to do, the challenges that London faces over the next 10, 20, even 30 years. And we know what the shape of the problems are in London, don't we? We know about the youth unemployment, about illiteracy, 54,000 18 to 24-year-olds are currently out of work. We know about the deep pockets of poverty in many of our boroughs. We know about the housing problems we've got. We know about the rates of illiteracy at 11. We know also that these problems are likely, unless we act, unless we plan, unless we work together, these problems are likely to get substantially more difficult. I'll tell you why. Because Londoners, thanks to the natural fecundity and philoprogenitive instincts of our great people, are reproducing at a phenomenal rate. You know, they are. There's nothing, absolutely nothing we can do to stop it. They are by 2015, 3 years' time, 2 years' time, virtually, we will reach 8.6 million, the biggest this city has ever been, the most numerous this city has ever been. By 2020, we will hit 9 million people, 9 million in the city. We will reach that figure, but we're far the most populous city in Europe. Now we will reach 9 million before New York. And going on to 2020, demographic projections indicate that we can expect to go up to 10 million. Now, in that context, we need to provide. And we need to think about what London is going to look and feel like. We will need another 300,000 more homes. We will need 500,000 more jobs, at least. And the infrastructure bill alone, leaving out the new airport, which we need, the infrastructure bill alone, roads, rail, housing, the infrastructure bill alone is £75 billion. And that is why it is so vital that we work together as far as we possibly can. We remember that Olympic spirit of cooperation and coordination and laying aside party differences. We work together to create what we're calling the 2020 Vision for London. And we look at all the aspects of our great city that we need to advertise to government as in need of attention. The spatial development, all the opportunities that there are for investment around the city, everywhere from Brent Cross, the docks, VNEB, Croydon, Tottenham, you know the list of fantastic opportunity areas. Many of them so far deprived of the vital transport they need, links that they need in order to develop the housing that we will require. We know, roughly speaking, what transport infrastructure we need to put in to cope with a city of 9, 10 million. We know about the need for Crossrail 2. We understand the imperative for new river crossings, but we've got to set it out, and we know about the need for better education for London kids, for greater attainment in our schools, and we know about the need for better health outcomes in some of the poorest boroughs in London. But I think we will benefit immensely as a city if we set this out in a powerful, punchy, I was going to say polemical, I don't see the harm in that, a powerful, punchy, polemical way to government, to our stakeholders, to Whitehall, so that they understand what London needs. And then, working together, we can do the things that will make London succeed. And, of course, you know what they are. Making it ever safer. Working with the police are committed now to reducing crime by a further 20%. It's vital that we fight for the resources to keep our police out on the streets. It's vital we make London ever more attractive, a place to live in and move around in. We'll have more bicycles. I don't know how welcome that is. Not really. Well, some lots of shaking of heads here from some conservative councillors. Never mind. We will plant more trees. How about that? Yeah. We will do all sorts of things to improve the amenity of London, to make it a more attractive place to live in and to, as I say, to put in the infrastructure that the greatest city on earth needs. And if we do that, and if we get it right, and if we build this consensus that I would like to see around the future of London, then the natural genius of Londoners will do the rest. And as I never tire of telling you, this is a quite extraordinary city. It's not just that we export all kinds of things around the world that you would never have dreamed of, like tea to China and TV aerials from Wandsworth to Korea. You can probably recite this list better than I can now. What are the other things? Rice from Havering to India. Give me another one. Bicycles, thank you, well done. Bicycles from Chiswick all the way to Holland and indeed to Japan. But London is incredibly fertile in discovering new forms of employment. And I was amazed the other day to see not just that there is anxiety about the decline of the numbers employed in the city from the CEBR study, but that the projections now for the growth in the tech sector are quite astonishing. And this is a sector in the Shoreditch area, around Hackney, all that area that you know of, much of it in Jules's patch now. This is a sector that has gone from virtually nil to employing 40,000 people in the last 5 or 6 years. 40,000 people is a huge number. There is no limit to London's versatility. And we can create those opportunities if we in the public sector work together to get the fundamentals right. That is the point of the 2020 vision. That's why I hope that you'll work with us, London councils, together with City Hall, so that we can lay out a vision for government and for the country as a whole of London as not just the economic powerhouse of the southeast and of the UK, which indeed it is, the economic motor of this country, but the greatest commercial, financial, cultural, artistic capital on earth. That is the vision. That is the point of having a 2020 vision. It will help us not just to deal with the real challenges that we face in this city, the real challenges of poverty and underachievement, but also to lengthen our lead as the greatest city on earth. Thank you very, very much indeed for having me along this morning, and I hope to work with you to achieve our 2020 vision. Thank you.
Now, we have a very short amount of time, 10 minutes or so, for some questions. So I'm going to implore you, please, say who you are and where you're from, but please ask a quick and pithy question on one subject. And then if we take a group of three, we'll see how we get on and see if we can manage any others. But the Mayor has got to go in about 10 minutes. So if people can sort of show some hands, there's a lady just on the sort of start of the back row there. If you'd like to ask the first question, thank you very much.
Councillor Anne Hutton, London Borough Barnet. The Mayor has just said that he's committed to reducing crime by a third, and we need to get the fundamentals right. In my ward, the community police service has been cut by half, and there is only, in Barnet, which is one of the largest London boroughs, there is only one police station operating 24/7. So how do you manage to square the two?
Thank you. Could you just say who you were again? Madam, I didn't catch it.
I'm sorry. I'm Councillor Anne Hutton, London Borough of Barnet.
Thank you very much. And we have a gentleman there in the... Sorry, yes, where Ollie is, please. Thank you very much.
Councillor Nicholas Russell from the London Borough of Waltham Forest. Also in terms of guaranteeing safety, how is this squared with the... forthcoming cuts to fire stations and reduction in fire appliances. For example, where I'm from, it's rumoured that there's going to be a 50% cut in fire appliances with reduction from 2 to 1 engine, both in Leighton and Leightonstone fire station, which is actually in my ward.
Thank you. And I have a lady, Ollie, just at the front of... there we are. Thank you very much.
Councillor Janet Langhorne from London Borough of Richmond. I would like the Mayor's reassurance as to the future of the Freedom Pass and bus passes after 2015, please. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take those three.
Okay, right. On crime in Barnet, clearly the acid test is what's happening to the key crime indicators. And they, as far as I know, though, I'll get you the the detailed figures, they continue to be positive in the sense they're coming down across the board. There has been a problem with burglary, which is being addressed, and there has been a spike in some places in robbery, but that is now coming down. Overall crime continues to fall. When people let me be clear, there are going to be arguments in the months ahead about the configuration of police buildings and the stock of police stations and exactly how they operate. The critical thing, and I really would urge colleagues to think rationally about this, the critical thing is that we get more police out on the streets and that the public has an opportunity as much as possible to interface with the police. And that means, if police stations, old inadequate buildings have to be closed or changed, then there will always be cover in the form of new access, a new police counter put in its place. We cannot keep our current estate completely frozen. In aspect, it would be completely, it would be financial madness, and it wouldn't be in the interests of the safety of Londoners. So I do urge some reasonableness and some thinking ahead that it will be necessary to make changes. And the same point really can be made to Nicholas Russell from Waltham Forest, who asked about fire stations. Again, I'm sure that colleagues will appreciate there are going to be arguments coming down the track. There will be, you've seen already, the FBU campaign. I think the idea that we can't change a jot or tittle of the fire station estate is simply wrong, and it will be necessary to make some changes, but they will be done so as to maximise fire cover and to continue the excellent work of the London Fire Brigade over the last 10 years in bringing down steadily, as they have done, not just fires but deaths from fire as well. That is the objective, and insofar as there are the priority will be to maximise fire cover, fire appliances, and only then to consider the importance of fire stations of bricks and mortar. We should not fetishise bricks and mortar. And I urge colleagues to be rational in your calculations about how this is to be achieved. Janet from Richmond asks about the Freedom Pass post 20. The Freedom Pass is, of course, delivered by London councils, and I congratulate London councils. As long as I am mayor, I intend there to be a 24-hour Freedom Pass. That was the promise I made in 2008 when I was elected. I cannot guarantee what a future Labour mayor might do, but I leave that. I leave your flesh to creep with that that thought.
While you get control of your flesh, there's a gentleman here in the front. If we can go to him first.
Thank you, Chairman. Martin Day, City of London Corporation. I'd like to ask the Mayor if he could develop his proposal for hypothecating or ring-fencing some of the tax revenue generated in London so that it's spent in London, and possibly staunch the leakage and flow up to Scotland of a lot of it.
Sorry. Another gentleman just here with glasses.
Thank you very much, Councillor Maurice Groves, London Borough of Merton. You were talking about high technology. High technology is nothing new to London. We developed in the Science Museum a mechanical computer in the 1890s, and indeed Tommy Flowers at Donis Hill in the GPO probably developed the first electronic one. Can you please reassure me that funding will still flow towards South West London for high technology as well, so that we can develop our apprenticeship schemes?
Thank you. And there's a lady next to the councillor who asked a question from Richmond a moment ago, just in the first row of the second set. Thank you.
Councillor Sunita Gordon from Sutton. I would like to ask the Mayor, what will be the main difference or benefit to the children of London if the schools were run by the London Mayor? Thank you.
Boris, do you want to...
Yes. First of all, on the tax issue and what we can do to, you know, make the government see sense and invest properly in London. That's, I think, the priority. The argument is not zero sum. The argument is win-win. What we're saying to government is, if you invest properly in the motor of the UK economy, then you'll generate economic growth throughout the country. And you only have to look at the impact of London on the wider UK economy to see that that is true. There would be no financial services industry in Edinburgh if there wasn't a vibrant financial services industry in London. We buy training rolling stock that basically keeps a huge number of people in employment in Derby, and so on and so forth. And I think the government does understand the driving role of London. There is a tax export in good times. I mean, I think it's up to about £18-20 billion from London to the rest of the UK economy. What we're asking Tony Travers and the Independent Finance Commission to look at is ways in which the tax revenue that London generates could be more sensibly allocated towards the creation of further growth and jobs in London for the benefit of the wider UK economy. I don't want to anticipate what Tony and his colleagues are going to come up with, but that work will be done in parallel with the 2020 vision, so that, again, we can go to government and say, this is what London needs. These are the great targets for our city. And here, by the way, in case you're worried about the bill, here, by the way, is an intelligent and attractive way that you could think of financing it. So the argument has two strands. On high tech and apprentices, I think that the sector that we're talking about, which is growing so fast, actually has huge scope to take on young people who may not be brilliant, have been brilliant at their schoolwork. But they all sure as hell know how to use a BlackBerry and stop it going off in the middle of a speech or whatever. They understand this stuff. But there is real, real scope to get people, young people, into apprenticeships in the tech sector. If you've got some specific ideas or plans that need support, then we're only too happy to help. Kit Malthouse is on the case. As I said earlier on, the apprenticeship program is a big part of what we're trying to do. Or perhaps I didn't say it with sufficient clarity. Between now and 2016, we want to put on another 250,000 apprenticeships in London. The tech sector obviously will be a big part of that. And I was asked, I think, from Sutton about the so-called ambitions of the London mayor to run schools. Colleagues, friends, there is no such ambition. There is no such ambition. Let's be clear, all we're trying... I do have a responsibility for skills and for economic outcomes and for equality in this city. And I have to think about ways in which I can champion good outcomes, champion literacy, try to help, try to stimulate, and try to encourage best practice. And that's all that we're trying to do. There is no land grab envisaged. There is no... All that we're offering in a humble and collegiate spirit is collaboration and support for what I think is the interests of London kids.
OK, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, so let's just try and really rattle through one more quick set. There's a gentleman right at the back. Thank you.
Councillor Nicholas Bennett, London Borough of Bromley. Boris, in your election campaign, you promised to extend the Docklands Light Railway from Lewisham to Bromley. Have you told the Transport for London Board, because they don't seem to know about it?
Well, they do. They do. It's just they. I'll answer in a minute.
Okay. And
they don't. They claim not to have the money yet, Nicholas. That's the problem. But I'll explain.
Another gentleman standing right at the back, and then also finally, there's a gentleman just here, which will take us the third one.
Councillor Clyde Lakes, London Borough, Waltham Forest. It was welcome to get a letter from you about your tree fund this week, Boris. I just wonder what your plans are to help local authorities who are going to have to deal with the consequences of ash dieback. We already estimate that we're going to have to take 2,000 trees down at a cost of around about £800,000.
Thank you. And gentlemen...
£800,000 per borough? Really?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Councillor Swaran Pada from London Borough of Ealing. From my neck of the wood, it's... we have consultation of closing four A&Es from the hospitals. That's Ealing Hospital, Central Middlesex, Charing Cross, and Hammersmith. What is your take on that? How would you support our campaign against the closures?
Okay, DLR Trees and
yes.
A&E.
Okay, on Nicholas Bennett on from Bromley. In an ideal world, I would love to start work now on the DLR extension to Bromley. I have to say that the business case is not as strong. Let me put it as strong as some other things that we need to do immediately. But it would be a good thing to do. The difficulty is that it would be very expensive, and I really put it to you and to everybody else in Bromley that it will be necessary to raise a very substantial sill in order to do so. And I just hope that we can talk productively about how there might be cooperation between TfL and Bromley to achieve that. Clyde, on ash dieback. I hadn't realised that, forgive me, I hadn't realised that the bill was already reaching that kind of level for the problem. I will get our people to see what we can do, because clearly this is going to require a pan-London approach. If boroughs are individually facing problems of the thick end of £1 million caused by ash dieback, then we need to look at it across the city as a whole. I'll get Matthew Penchart's onto it immediately, and Clyde, we will come back to you as soon as we can. Ealing A&Es, thank you very much. I had a delegation, as I'm sure you know, from doctors in Ealing, from members of all parties in Ealing who were concerned about what's happening to the hospitals in that part of London. All I can tell you is, obviously, I don't have strategic oversight of the hospitals. I have written to Jeremy Hunt making the various points that were put to me. But again, I'm afraid I'm going to have to be candid with colleagues here and say again that we all have to recognise that in tough financial times it is right to make changes, but also that it may be that there are changes that you have to make that aren't actually even financially dictated. And one of the interesting arguments that's been put to me about the reconfiguration of hospitals in North West London is that the coverage at the moment is so, particularly at weekends, is so episodic and so random that actually 130 lives are being lost every year that might be saved by a sensible reconfiguration. Now, that is the point that is put to me by NHS London. Whether it is true or not is not really within my powers to evaluate. But what I'm saying to you and to everybody here is when we consider the fate of local police stations, of local fire stations, of local A&Es, there is always, because we're all politicians of one kind or another, there is always the temptation to go for the quick headline and think about saving a particular piece of bricks and mortar, when actually some kind of reconfiguration might be in the interests of our constituents. I'm just offering that as a caveat to the temptation that I think will be very strong now in our city for a great deal of alarm about changes and reforms that are proposed. I'm not saying that, and I will be ruthless in defending. I've many a hospital I have defended and kept open. Many a police station I will fight for. Many a fire station we will keep open. But it is vital that people are rational and reasonable and separate out what is obvious political claptrap from what is necessary to be done.
Can I thank all the questioners for following the brief so assiduously? Can I thank the Mayor for giving up his time on Saturday morning, for getting off to such an excellent start? And I'm sure we'd all like to thank him very
much
indeed.
Thank you very much.
Right. Can I invite Mark Boliat to join us on the stage? I should say that As Jules said, we are hugely in debt to the City of London, both for their support